In this week's episode of Mooney Goes Wild, how will you celebrate the Year of the Fly?
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today we hear about ambitious new research by NUIG exploring one of the last frontiers on the planet, the Indian Ocean. Terry Flanagan goes in search of our best-loved diving bird, the Dipper, and we celebrate the Year of the Fly.
2019 is the year of the fly, no less. This is the year set aside that we should learn more about flies. Now, flies are important pollinators. They're decomposers of dead plants and animals. They carry out debridement. They help with forensics. They've contributed a huge amount to our knowledge of genetics. But actually, the public profile of flies is often that of dirty, disease-carrying, high-frequency buzzing, egg-laying pests.
So, a busy show ahead of us today. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Ken Whelan is with me in studio today. How are you, Ken? Haven't seen you for a while.
Very well indeed, Derek. Thank you very much.
I know you're going to Seattle during the summer. What are you going up there for?
As we mentioned on a programme a few weeks ago, this is the International Year of the Salmon. So there's a very big event on in Seattle in August, and it's the Salmon Forum. And this one isn't for a different sort of approach. It's not being driven directly by scientists. It's being driven more by the stakeholders, by people who are really interested in migratory fish. And it's not just salmon, even though it's called the Salmon Forum. They're looking at interesting things like migratory trout as well. And there's going to be a great mix of things. There's going to be science, there's going to be management, and there's going to be the interaction really between the science and the management and communicating how best to actually manage these very scarce resources.
Meaning?
Well, scarce in the sense that we have seen in several locations, including in North America now with the Chinook salmon, that these migratory fish can actually disappear very quickly. And the one thing you can't do is take them for granted. And even though you might see thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of them today, it doesn't take a huge event for them suddenly to start to dwindle. And suddenly people are scratching their heads and they're saying, ooh, wonder what happened there. So I think by joining forces between the Atlantic and the Pacific, we're beginning to understand now the way to approach these and how they might be managed.
Are salmon stocks good?
Very difficult to actually answer that question in the broadest sense across all oceans because, for example, in the Pacific, they do a huge amount of enhancement. So there are food fisheries created in the Pacific by releasing vast numbers of baby salmon from places like Korea and Japan and North America. You wouldn't even think of Japan and Korea being involved, but they're big players in terms of releasing these fish. So the ocean is full of salmon, but the question is whether or not the wild salmon are doing well. And some stocks, for instance, the chum salmon seems to be at its absolute historic max in the Pacific Ocean at the moment, but some individual stocks of the great big salmon, the king salmon, are showing signs of being under very serious stress. So people don't really understand the interaction and how the ocean is affecting these, and that's part of the reason for going to Seattle to try and find out more about this.
Yeah, would you know the difference between a farmed salmon and a wild salmon?
Yeah, very quickly.
I don't mean on the plate.
No. In the wild, yeah. I think, well, I would, because of the fact that I've been looking at the two different types for so long.
What's the difference?
You can see, generally, you can see some erosion in the fins on the farmed fish because they're living so closely together. In some cases, it's very obvious. You'd have a slightly deformed fin or maybe a major deformation in a fin. In other cases, for example, particularly the dorsal fin, it's almost invariably the case that the dorsal fin has a kink in it if it's a reared fish. And I don't know what creates that, but it's an artifact of them being reared together and being fed together then. But very often, too, the coloration is different. So if you look at a farm salmon, it might look like the most beautiful fish you've ever seen on ice and so on. But if you look, you'll see that a lot of spots actually go down below the lateral line. You get some spots on the tail and so on. And these are artifacts of the rearing and the actual crossbreeding process. So for an experienced eye, you'd actually tell them apart very quickly. But certainly for the average punter, it would be very difficult.
So you say they're releasing these in millions of them into the Pacific Ocean.
The Pacific Ocean.
But they're releasing them from where? They're releasing them from holding pens?
From hatcheries.
From hatcheries. Okay, so they're not releasing them from rivers.
No.
So where are these salmon coming back to? I mean, if ours leave a river here,
yeah,
They're coming back. Well, they're going to end their days here in the same river, right where they were spawned.
They come back in that case as well. They do actually come back in certain situations. They come back to the release point, if not to the river itself. But very large numbers of the fish are caught before they get back. So the idea is it's called ocean ranching. And as the name implies, it's not ocean farming. So what you do is you rear the baby salmon until they're maybe about 10 or 15 centimetres long, release them into the ocean, let them feed in the ocean. And then because of their instinct to come back, they have a tendency then to come back, and you can catch them in traps or you can catch them in the nets. But in the case of the Pacific, they catch very large numbers of fish in the nets. And this interplay between the wild and the farmed fish is quite a difficulty in terms of trying to manage the wild fish amongst all of the reared fish.
Can I ask, has there been a case to date of any farmed fish ending up in rivers where wild fish came from and breeding?
Oh yeah. Well, that's been well documented at this stage. Yeah,
I thought you were going to say no. Absolutely not.
Oh no, it's been well documented, and that was originally one of the concerns. It continues to be one.
Genetically,
of the concerns.
Would be a big concern. You would have thought.
And certainly in Norway, there are very good data, very very solid scientific information showing the interaction. In Ireland, we're blessed in the sense that our rivers tend to produce very large numbers, relatively speaking, of small salmon. In Norway, they produce small numbers of giant salmon. And it's all a numbers game. So if you have a situation where you have an accidental escape of reared fish into a situation where you have a modest number of wild fish, it's much easier for these escapes to swamp that particular population. Mm. And they've been able to track it now genetically and show the level of introgression from the farmed fish into the wild fish.
Why are they going to the river?
Well, very often what happens is that the fish escape from the cage and then wander around, then they start to mature. And as far as we can see then, they just bolt up rivers. They have an instinct to go and spawn, and they go up into the nearest river.
Even though they're farmed salmon, yes. they still have the instinct to go in and to spawn.
And they seem to be quite poor at spawning, which is, from the wild fish point of view, a very good thing. So they wander all over the place, and they go up blind alleys and so on. But some of them do succeed in spawning both with themselves, and they're more successful breeding with other farmed fish than they are with wild. But certainly some of them do interbreed with the wild fish.
Ken, you're a marine biologist. You must be very concerned about that report from the United Nations a couple of weeks ago.
At this stage now, this is serious, serious stuff. I'm really glad to see the level of attention that it has actually drawn to the issues that as marine biologists we've been speaking about for 2-3 decades or more. We no longer have the opportunity now to actually put this off. We have to take a serious, serious look at what needs to be done. Glad in one way and concerned in another that every politician in the place now has jumped onto the bandwagon. Mm. So that's a very good thing. But we need considered actions. We don't just need everyone saying, oh, well, we'll have to do one thing or another. This is a whole series of different actions that we have to take. But the most important message is that every single person can actually contribute to this by being conscious themselves of what they're actually doing. I firmly believe we can't keep imagining that we can grow economies by 5%, 6%, and 7% and meet objectives that we're now saying we're going to meet in terms of climate change. We have to get used to the idea of a neutral economy.
Well, we've only been going on about this kind of stuff for 30 years on the radio programme, and now it's newsworthy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's the way things are, I suppose. But that's a good thing. At least people now are aware there is an issue and we can all do something to resolve it. You're going to be very interested in this next item. Ken, if you put your headphones on.